Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're going to talk about Katrina 5 years later, and there is a great deal to talk about with that from the different experiences in those communities. And we are have a pleasure to be joined once again by Davida Finger, who is assistant clinical professor at Loyola University College of Law in New Orleans, where she works for the Katrina Clinic. Tracy Washington is president and CEO of the Louisiana Justice Institute, a civil rights legal advocacy group. Michael Johnson is with us. He is a local activist, founder and executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute, who responded as part of the relief effort immediately after Hurricane Katrina, continued to be active in the fight to rebuild the Gulf Coast, who joins us by phone because he's also out of town today. Kathleen Koch is a former CNN correspondent who reported live from the Gulf during the Hurricane Katrina on the destruction of her hometown, Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. She's the author of the book Rising from Katrina, How My Mississippi Hometown Lost It All and Found What Mattered. And this Thursday, August 26th, Kathleen will be at the Barnes & Noble and on Montgomery Road in Ellicott City to sign copies of her book. She's with us here in the studio tonight.
That's right. Thank you for having me.
Folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, glad you're with us. Michael Johnson.
Hey.
So, Davida, let me start with you, Davida and Tracy. I know, Davida, you have a very short time with us, and I want to, if I could block out your leaving, I would, but I can't. Let me begin and go to Tracy. I want to talk about what you see as the state of things 5 years after Katrina, because I'll read some stats here in a minute, but they're not very good. It depends on whether you're looking from above or from below, I think. Davida?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. We put out something called the Katrina Pain Index to try to put very real numbers in front of folks who are looking at what the recovery actually looks like kind of from the street level, from the ground up, and it's very sobering. For folks who are having the hardest time at Katrina, most economically vulnerable, it's been very hard to come back, to get through the barriers, to get access to housing, to get access to good education, and folks continue to have a pretty hard time. Of course, there has been rebuilding, and I think a bright spot for everyone here has been kind of the attention that regular people from the country and really from around the world have given to you know, regular people here in the rebuilding. I think that most of the rebuilding that's gotten done has actually gotten done through the efforts of volunteers. And we need to recognize how much more still has to happen here, how flawed many of the government rebuilding programs were, and how much people have gone through, especially with everything this past summer with BP.
Tracy, and I do want to refer to what you were just talking about before I turn over to Tracy, Davida, that it'll be on our website, Katrina Pain Index 2010 New Orleans, 5 years later, by Bill Quigley, Davida Finger, and Lance Hill. Was published in commondreams.org on August 6, 2010, and it is very illuminating. We're going to go through some of that in the course of this. And Tracy Washington, I'd like to get your perspective.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Today I have the opportunity to do something that I don't take a lot of time to do often, and that is to just drive around. I was trying to get some air and clear my head, and I found myself driving around the Desire, Florida area. And it occurred to me as I was returning to the office that we've really had a redlined recovery. I think folks know what it means to be redlined. I think this nation will look, and you know, the world will look 5 years post Katrina and wonder where all of the money has gone. If you drive through the Lower Ninth Ward and Gentilly and other parts of the city, smaller parts of the city, these are the areas that this country saw as the areas with the greatest devastation. They are also the areas where we find our largest populations of African Americans and most marginalized citizens. And these are the areas to this day, 5 years later, where we don't see schools, where housing has not been rebuilt adequately. There are no hospitals. The street infrastructure is horrible. And one must wonder, what happened to the billions of dollars? Because, again, folks sent money based on those pictures. And 5 years later, you've got to wonder, what happened to the money if the pictures are still the same? We've had a redlined recovery.
The points you're making here are, I think, are critical that I want to examine bit by bit, Davida, Tracy and Davida. And I'd like to turn for a minute here, though, to our other guest here, Kathleen Koch, because your experience was in the Gulf of Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what I've read about the Gulf and talking to people who have come back from there is that it also is very different on the same class and race basis in terms of how things have been redeveloped.
Mm-hmm. A lot of similarities to what both Davida and Tracy were saying. As far as volunteers, we on the Mississippi Gulf Coast would not be anywhere near where we are today without the volunteers who have poured into Mississippi by the hundreds of thousands. I mean, more than 500,000 volunteers have come down there and started to put things right, rebuild homes for people who really had nowhere else to turn. But what we have also seen are the same sorts of redlining recoveries. I will say, even in my hometown of Bay St. Louis, for years and years, a low-income housing development sat there. And the homes were not that badly damaged to the naked eye. They looked repairable. And the people, the senior citizens, the lower-income citizens of town who lived there wanted to return. And I kept asking, why isn't this being repaired? Why isn't this being repaired? And they said, this is HUD. This is HUD housing. The city official said, we don't have anything to do with it. And finally, they just tore them all down. And so there is no more government-supported housing in my tiny town. And I think that's happened a lot on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. It is going to eventually be rebuilt. But why has it taken this long?
This is Michael, I want you to jump in when you need to here on this part of the conversation. I don't know when the last time you were there, but I think that one of the issues here, and I want you to come in after this with Davida and Tracy. I want to get a little analysis from you all about what you think is happening here and why. When I see the statistics that were in your report, Davida, in the piece you wrote with Bill Quigley and Lance Hill, the numbers of people who are African American, low income, who have not returned to Mississippi, who do not have housing, it's stunning.
Well,
go ahead, please. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, at least from the perspective of New Orleans, where we are in Louisiana, there have been serious systemic issues and serious issues of systemic racism. We need only to look at our housing recovery programs to see that very clearly. For years, we worked hard on individual cases through the Road Home Program, which was the program set up in Louisiana to disperse federal rebuilding dollars to folks who were entitled to it. And just last week, we hear in the ruling from the judge that the program that was set up indeed discriminated on race basis. For those of us working through the program, we've always known that to be true, and I don't think we needed a federal judge to tell us that, but it should help the country understand what's actually happened here. And to look at our neighborhoods and see the how hard the recovery is in historically African American neighborhoods, especially what's happened with the money. We have other programs like the NOAA program that was set up by the city to disperse funds that simply went under. No one knows what happened to it, and the millions of dollars that were put into that program at the local level. For house remediation. So I think we have serious systemic issues before us, and I don't know, but I suspect that there are probably similar issues going on in Mississippi.
I mean, Tracy, when we have one-third of all Social Security recipients, as I've been reading in this piece, have not returned to New Orleans.
Well, it is difficult to return to New Orleans. This is a tough place to live right now.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have significant enough or, you know, enough income where you could live probably very comfortably in any other community, you would be very hard-pressed to live here. Let's think about the fact that prior to Hurricane Katrina, a significant portion of our population were low-wage workers. They survived, but they survived through, for all intent and purposes, being subsidized by the social programs that this nation and this state provided. We had subsidized education, subsidized housing, subsidized health care, subsidized substantial transportation. When you return, the public transportation system was down. There were no schools, and now we have schools that charge such exorbitant fees, even as public schools, they're to the point of absurd. We have no real public hospital system here, and there is no affordable housing to speak of. And so if you are, you know, a doctor, lawyer, engineer, it's tough, but it's not ridiculous. But anyone else who was making, at the time of the storm, you know, $10 an hour changing bed sheets at a hotel finds themselves still making $10 an hour changing bed sheets at a hotel, but their rent payments have increased 200%. Electricity, utilities, transportation, and the like have also increased in cost, and it is very difficult to be here. Unfortunately, I'll say this in closing, these are the people who make up the culture of our city. It's where we get our music, our food, our individuality as a community, as a city, that makes us different from San Francisco or San Antonio or Austin or New York or Charlotte. And so when you remove that character from a city, what's left?
I do want to explore that with you all before you have to leave. And Michael Johnson, let me get your thoughts on that. The last statement you made, I think, I want to get everybody's reflections on what the future is going to be. Michael, I haven't heard from you yet, so why don't you go ahead?
Well, no, I mean, I'm just privileged and proud to be on the show with such informed people. I mean, you know, let's be clear. There are 18,700 zip codes that are being used by people that used to live in one ward. You know, 18,700 zip codes that are being used by people that used to live in one ward. And just a mere fact, and I love the term that you use, the red line recovery, because it's absolutely, absolutely true. I mean, you have people who mostly lived there with family, and family of family, and family of family. So when the storm came, folk didn't get an opportunity to travel to California and live with other family because all family was in Louisiana. So now we have a situation now where $62.3 billion of recovery aid cannot even be explained where it's been used. So it's not that I don't have anything to say. I'm just obviously enjoying the conversation, but I know how it was when I landed there in Baton Rouge and almost got arrested on my first day in Baton Rouge when I said to some of the people who were standing out of the heat in the Cajun Dome, or the Dome, I think that's what it was called, when they said how they were being treated, and I said, well, why don't you volunteer? And I was ceremoniously marched at gunpoint out of it and said that I was inciting people because they already have enough trouble down there where blacks think they're not being treated fairly. And that was within 6 hours after I had landed. So I knew I was in a different place. But I didn't think that America, nor the state of Louisiana, Mississippi, or Texas, would treat its people in accordance that it's been treating its people 5 years ago.
Some thoughts? Kathleen?
I just wanted to jump in a little bit and talk about the people who are most devastated by Hurricane Katrina in Mississippi, because that's one area that there's a huge difference from New Orleans. Very interestingly, in Mississippi, those who lost their homes, I mean, in their entirety, where they were just swept clean and they were only slabs, they tended to be the higher income people along the Mississippi Gulf Coast because they could afford to live right on the water.
The beach property.
Exactly. Well, if you were of means, you had a home on the water, overlooking the water, near the water. And so, interestingly, up and down the Mississippi Gulf Coast, it was often the lower income residents who lived further inland from the water who had less damage. I tell in my book a story of a woman who, one of the hardest working women in Bay St. Louis, and Diane Frederick, and her home had only about 3 feet of water, so she was one of the very fortunate ones. Whereas one of the families living up right almost on the beach that she'd worked for years, they lost everything. And they had recently sold her a small car she was going to give to her teenage daughter. She gave it back to them. She said, y'all keep it as long as you need it. I'm fine. I've you know, I have a house. I have something to work with here. I'm lucky. And so it's been very interesting. Yes, there were small homes. They weren't all mansions, as anyone who's ever been there knows, up and down the Mississippi Gulf Coast. There are a lot of modest family homes up and down on the water. But you have seen a struggle to come back for everyone, and much of that for the wealthier families or just even middle income is because of the insurance companies. And I know in New Orleans they've wrestled with them too.
I do want to talk a bit about the insurance companies and the role they've played in all this and what the federal government and state governments have done with the insurance companies. And as I get there, though, I want to come back to the last thing that you said, Tracy Washington, which had to do with the culture of the community, the makeup of the community, and how it has just changed. I think that people, you know, for the most part, people who view American media aren't aware of the almost permanent changes, it seems, that have taken place in the character of Louisiana and New Orleans. Because it's not just New Orleans, it's all of Louisiana this is taking place in southern Louisiana. But and what do you all think that portends for the future of the place that you grew up in and loved?
Well, for me, you know, the most significant thing I think about when I think about culture is what my 17-year-old will miss. You know, I'm at an age now where I have wonderful memories, and I know my culture, I know my history. But it's not only what he can't hear in music and you know, just the nightlife here. I think about how much I've learned from just the old folks who used to come to my law office in the morning, my father's friends, and sit around and just talk, read the paper with me. When we lose that significant portion of our population, and so many of our elderly, not only in New Orleans, but all along the Gulf Coast, I'm sure folks in Biloxi and Gulfport experience the same thing. When they don't come back, we lose sort of that institutional knowledge, that oral history that is told and passed on that our kids need to know about. And that's what strikes me a lot. I don't know. Davita and I both grew up here, and so I'm sure she has the same or different perspective.
Davita?
Well, I always learn from Tracy's perspective, that's for sure, and agree wholeheartedly with that. I think the collective memory of what people here have is now different. You have kids who went to 6, 10, 12 different schools over the course of the last few years, and everything about home life and community life is different. What people will remember about their growing up experience is different. I think we all know that as hard as we try, we can't make it the same. But what we can try to do is make it equitable. And I think that we all feel the weight of those kind of issues on us now as we're seeing images of the days after the storm and the evacuation playing over and over again on TV again and really re-remembering how unjust, how deeply unjust everything was in the early days and how deeply unjust it continues to be for so many.
I just to explore a bit further, and I want folks to join us here at 410-319-8888. If you look at Katrina in New Orleans, Louisiana, and Mississippi 5 years later, and I know many of you listening to this program and have called in before are lived in New Orleans once and are no longer there and live around here or live around Washington or live around other places in this country and want you to give us your experiences and what you are thinking about it with your family and friends at 410-319-8888. And I'm curious from your perspectives, Tracy Washington, Davita Finger, what politically is going on around you? What groups are what is bubbling up from the bottom? What groups are organizing and working? And what is the political struggle like down there where you are now?
No, Davita, you go first.
Tracy, you know I have to defer to you. Struggle.
Okay, so age before beauty, I don't know. See, I'm a lot older. See, the landscape has changed. Keep in mind that prior to Hurricane Katrina, we had a majority African American city council. We had an African-American district attorney. We had an African-American mayor. He was for crap, but he was black.
And I can see why Tracy
had an African-American federal elected official in the second congressional district. Right after Katrina, you know, all of these folks, the, you know, sons and daughters of the Confederate gentry met in Dallas, sons and daughters of the Confederate gentry and our mayor, met in Dallas and made a plan of what they wanted this city to look like and charted a course. Now, you got to give them credit for being good devils, because they charted a course on how they wanted to change the complexion of this city. And that began with green spacing areas. That began with reforming schools. That began with privatizing what were formerly public services. And when you remake these things, when you remove sort of this social fabric, then you know that it's gone. And so it's been fun to watch.
On one level, fun.
On one level.
Fun like getting a waxing. I don't know. Fun.
Well, I have to come back and ask a question about what you just said, Tracy. But, Davida, you want to add to that?
How can I add anything to that, really? I have watched Tracy navigate all of this just with incredible finesse. She might remember that in one of the lawsuits we had against the city, when the city was demolishing homes as those homes were being rebuilt, and churches, Tracy's own house was put by the city on the demolition list, her own basically undamaged Katrina home at the time. So I think Tracy has, I know we all learn a lot from Tracy, but the way she has navigated that system has been, I don't know, incredible, artful, creative. There's been a lot that's happened.
My son puts on his Facebook page, "You all do understand my mother is crazy." And so we just all start from that perspective.
I do want to bring Kathleen and Michael back here, but I have to ask you one question, Tracy, what you were saying. Talk about what you said a moment ago about, flesh out a bit for us this idea you talked about the sons of the Confederacy gentry planning to change the face of New Orleans. Can you flesh it out for our listeners a little bit more about what you're saying with that?
Okay. So there was, I mean, I don't know how do you describe Confederate gentry? I mean, you know,
I have some words, but I won't use them on the air now.
It really is what it is. I mean, this was, you know, my father has this wonderful expression. He goes, "Well, before they would mask this stuff, Tracy, like during Mardi Gras, now you just walk down the street and they're whistling Dixie." It has always been this sort of myth that, you know, there was a need to take back New Orleans, you know, take back New Orleans from these, you know, blacks gone wild, which was really always funny to me, having, you know, moved back to New Orleans in my mid-30s, because it was just, you know, you had some black folk doing all right, you had a lot of black folk working for government, and you had a lot of poor black people. And I'm just thinking to myself, who are you taking it back from? I'll gladly give you my poverty if you give me your wealth. It was always sort of a strange thing. So this move to take back the city was really more just sort of to make this, I don't know, coup de grace, as it were, of really putting icing on the cake that was already made. This is a city that, for all intents and purposes, has never been run by black folk. We've just had black elected officials. A city is run by those folks who have the money and the means to run it. And so now they've just, you know, put that period at the end of the sentence, as far as I'm concerned. To the extent, you know, I laugh, because to the extent folks say, "Well, wow, you know, you've got a white mayor now instead of a black mayor, and you've got a white city council instead of a black city council," I don't know in my heart of hearts, except for access, you know, who I can pick up the phone and call when somebody is wrongfully put in jail. Can I call the chief anymore, and will he return my telephone calls? Probably not. But not much else has changed for me. You know.
I do hear you, and I'm curious what when we talk about how we look at what's going on now in the Gulf, the kinds of things that DeVita and Tracy, DeVita Washington and Tracy Finger.
No.
What did I say?
That would be DeVita Finger.
Oh, did I change your names? See, but I always do that to people. So you're just being blessed
that
on my show this way. I do it to everybody.
That was just culturally
incorrect. You know, this is my habit. I apologize. my dyslexic way of looking at the page. But what you both described here, Tracy Washington and DeVita Finger, is something that we never get in the media. These are the stories that don't come to the fore. This is the kind of analysis, whether people agree or disagree, that is underneath the surface that never sees the light of the media day.
It's complicated. You know, it's a complicated story. It's hard to tell. And it's a story that some people don't want to hear. You know, as I've been going around the South and talking about my book, Rising from Katrina, a lot of people, when they just hear the word Katrina, it's like, no, done. I know that story. I don't want to hear any more about it. And I think it's tough. I think it's tough for the mainstream media, especially when they don't know and understand the complexities of the Gulf Coast and of New Orleans, you know, the way DeVita and Tracy do, to really get in there and tell the story. They may not appreciate its importance. And again, you have to care. It's just, and it's been hard, I think, to find that. And because people say in the media, you know, nobody wants to hear about this anymore.
And we have to take a short break here. And Michael Johnson, when we come back from break, I want you to break out and talk a bit about what we just talked about.
Okay, absolutely.
I know you've been holding your tongue, but you've been really. I'm amazed how quiet you've been.
He's my Mississippi partner bank over there.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to get Michael in here. We do have to take a break. And the DeVita and Tracy, do you both have to leave?
I gotta go.
Who is that, Tracy? You have to go.
I do have to go, and I apologize.
I'm so sorry.
But Michael, I will see you on Thursday night, dear.
Okay.
See, now that means you all have to come back soon because you're just going to leave us like hanging out there like that.
You got a couple of best experts on the radio.
Well, we had questions for you. Wish you could stay.
We need to hear more from you. Tracy Washington is president and CEO of the Louisiana Justice Institute, a civil rights legal advocacy organization, and DeVita Finger, assistant clinical professor at Loyola University College of Law in New Orleans, where she works through Katrina Clinic. Have been with us before. They'll come back again, and I want to thank both of you for taking the time. And good luck, and we really do look forward to coming back and having you on to continue this conversation about our sister city, New Orleans.
Thank you
absolutely
so much.
This has been a great interview.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we're going to come back with Kathleen Koch and Michael Johnson, and you all at 410-319-8888. Please join us here. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. We are looking at 5 years after Katrina, but first I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information at 1-800-492-5538 or you can go to www.umm.edu/womenscenter. We are still joined in this conversation about the Gulf by Michael Johnson, who is the founder and executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute, longtime community activist who responded as part of the relief effort immediately after Hurricane Katrina and has continued to be active in the fight to rebuild the Gulf Coast. Kathleen Koch is a former CNN correspondent who reported live from the Gulf during the Hurricane Katrina on the destruction of her hometown, Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. She's the author of a new book, Rising from Katrina, How My Mississippi Hometown Lost It All and Found Out What Mattered. This Thursday, August 26th at 7 p.m., Kathleen will be at the Barnes & Noble on Montgomery Road in Ellicott City to sign copies of her book. And you can join us here with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. And I promised, Michael, we'll come right back to you, and you can start the conversation off.
Well, you know, two things. One, you know, I think that what the storm also did, it really opened up the responsibility of the media. If it wasn't for the media in the 7 to 8 days after we got there, we don't think that people would have really got what was really going on. The language of the media that described the so-called the victims of Katrina, you know, with the obsessions about violence more than about the victims, of how the picture, I think we all remember seeing the AP picture of the white couple helping themselves and the blacks who were looting, and yet it was an exact same picture. It was almost like it was a cartoon. It shows that the comparison with Third World in Africa, how they described Katrina. And, I mean, I can hear my friend say how it didn't really matter that you had black folk in office, but access sometimes helps even the poor. And now that there is lack of access, sections that will never be rebuilt in the Ninth Ward because they felt it wasn't necessary to rebuild it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you were speaking of 100,000 people, primarily African Americans and poor whites as well from some of the parishes who will never return. And if you're looking at a voting block or a political block, 100,000 people, if you were imagined, you could pluck out of Baltimore at any given time and think that you would have the same political landscape. Obviously, things were different. Now, the 9/11, which was an assault on the financial and military America, you know, that not only moved swift state response, you know, its victims were not black. They were a middle class, white and well off. And, you know, we tried to compare that. And one of the things that was so interesting for me was to sneak to the Ninth Ward because they had blocked the Ninth Ward off, and to see people still in houses 7 to 8 days, 6 and 7 days later, where they were having to carve open roofs, but yet the dogs and the animals from the zoo had been moved. And if we want to remember anything, it's that sense of what kind of human being responds. Was it that dogs out of the kennels and the animals out of the zoo were removed before the human beings out of New Orleans? And I did have a chance to get down to where the young lady is speaking about in Mississippi and Kentucky. And one of the things we saw during the rebuilding was how they were bringing in so many people from South America and had them camping out in woods to do some of the, what they call the roof, if you remember, the tops that they were putting on all of the roofs to stop the leaking and things. So it was a activist mind-changing thing for me. I got it. If I didn't get it from America in 1963, I certainly got it from America in 2005.
Michael Johnson, I'm going to come back to kind of explore more of what you just said. Kathleen Koch, on the way to kind of talking about your experience in the Gulf, again, this is it becomes almost like an unfinished story. Mm-hmm. What happened in the Gulf? I mean, we have not amnesia in this country, but we very quickly lose we can't focus and we lose our attention. So Katrina happened 5 years ago, but I think the state of our media is in a place where there's no one who has the wherewithal or the ability to take the power of a network or to go down and do the investigations to find out what's really going on 5 years later and what the real story is, as opposed to just kind of giving us the whitewash that we seem to get all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, networks, you know, they do have, I believe, the best of intentions. And you've seen a lot of reporting this week, retrospectives, looking back at Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans. But it's when the story gets complicated. I mean, it's just hard. It's hard to keep them focused. It's hard to get them to commit? And if there's not a personal connection, I mean, that's one of the ways I have been able to keep telling the story of the Mississippi Gulf Coast, you know, for years and years, because I, you know, when I worked at CNN, I had that personal connection, and the network saw it, and they felt it, and they said, hey, you know, okay, it's important, and people are listening. You know, the viewership we had for the documentaries that I did on my town was just off the charts. And also the responses that we got, the emails were, they had only gotten more viewer response to Warsaw Rising, a documentary that they'd done years earlier, but. It's just, you know, I wish that more places, I mean, obviously, you know, when you look over at Hurricane Ike and Galveston, Houston, talk about forgotten. I mean, that area was flattened in 08, and who have they had to champion their cause? Often if you don't have that personal connection, someone directly from your town who keeps at the network, at the newspaper, at the radio station, the radio network, you know, this is important. These people, and you're getting constant communication. You know, I may not live on the Gulf Coast anymore, but my brother does. And when you grow up in a town, when I moved there, 6,700 people, everyone is family. So you're hearing the problems, the realities of life that people are wrestling with on a daily basis. So then you take it back and you hammer your news director and the head of the network, and you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But not every area has that. And then you just eventually run up against a wall, because after a while they say, you know, we've told that story. We've done that. Let's move on.
So what's the story? Let's say, before we come back to Michael, I want Michael to bring back your kind of political thoughts about where we go from here, and because of what you see in your kind of community activism. But I'm curious, Kathleen Koch, first, a bit about the stories of your town, Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, and what's the untold story that you're telling here? Because I have not read your book.
Well, happened, that Mississippi was impacted, that there was this place just outside New Orleans. So many of the people in our town actually worked in New Orleans. But that was a different place, a tiny little town where, and it was just erased. You know, 95% of the town was underwater. We were hit by sustained 125-mile-an-hour winds, 145-mile-an-hour gusts, hopscotching tornadoes, a 30-plus-foot storm surge, this wall of water that just came roaring in and crushed everything. And we have no levees there. Our downtown is on it's the highest point in the United States, on the Gulf of Mexico. And so you just had this vast devastation, people losing everything. But because the Mississippi Gulf Coast is a smaller area, people know, everyone has a sense of being part of a family, people just reached out and cared for one another in a way that was remarkable to me. I knew these were special people. I love them. I grew up there. But just the caring that I saw, and it really did cross racial lines. And to a point, interestingly, that Michael brought up earlier, we had sanctioned looting. Our public officials, the mayors, the supervisors of the county, they went in to the Kmart, the Walmart, where there were shelves that were higher than 10, 12, 14 feet where the water had surged in. They said, hey, we need this food, we need this water. And they opened it up and they started giving people food, because no help came for about a week. And you had to keep the people alive.
The officials in the town.
Oh, they did. Yes, they broke
literally
into stores.
Literally sanctioned looting. They were putting people in jail for New Orleans.
Exactly. No, in Mississippi, they were handing out the food, because it was like, hey, you know, what is the store going to do with this now anyway? The store is ruined, so let's salvage what we can. Let's take care of one another. And there was this spirit. I'm not saying there were no crimes that occurred. I'm not saying there was no illegal looting, people benefiting from the situation. Or people, you know, people stole other people's generators. It happened on the Gulf Coast. Yes, there were criminal acts. But for the most part, what I saw was just this way that these people, when the attention turned to New Orleans, they just pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and went, you know, I guess they kind of forgot about us. We better take care of ourselves and take care of one another. And you saw people going to help friends and neighbors before they even went to see what was left of their own home. And you saw people just getting out chainsaws, coming up, everyone pooling their resources and working together to clear the streets, to feed the neighborhood, to care for one another. It was just simply awe-inspiring. And you didn't hear a lot of complaining, which floored me. The adjective that I heard more people in Mississippi use over the last 5 years to describe themselves is blessed. And you would look around the debris fields that stretched as far as the eye could see, in particular up where I had grown up on the beach, And you'd say, you know, don't you mean cursed? Are you seeing what I am seeing? You know, how can you have this optimistic all for one and one for all and we'll rebuild bigger and better attitude? But it's just in their nature. And when everyone lost everything, you know, that's what are we going to do? Just sit here, rip out our hair, cry and scream about it. Let's get to work fixing things. And it was just astonishing to see. And I wanted to tell their story. And, you know, 5 years later, I think it's good to understand the fullness of the Katrina story.
I must, well, if you think politically, what the difference is between the two places in this sense, that when you look at New Orleans and you look at, as you said, the amount of public housing, you said the public housing unit in your town was never mm-hmm. rebuilt. So those folks who lived there didn't participate in this rebuilding because they were not back. That was my chair just falling down. Pull it back up.
They got creative. They moved in with friends and family who weren't living there. But a lot of them aren't back. You're right. 20% of the population isn't back in our county and in our town.
And many of the people who rebuilt their homes owned these homes. These were their homes.
Mm. On the beach. Good number of them. Mm-hmm.
And the difference with that and Michael Johnson with New Orleans is the amount of people who didn't own their homes, or even if they did, had the government and everyone else condemn the homes and not allow folks to move back in.
Oh, absolutely. It was only maybe 38, 39% of homeowners in Ward 9 who actually lived in a home that they owned. And some of them lived in their homes for generations or lived on that land for generations and rebuilt their homes. And I think that the difference is the fact that where the government had it's almost like the African Americans at a whole, we suffer from double disenfranchisement. I mean, we're sitting there living there, but we're living there because we have, like you say, public transportation, public schools, public hospitals. And so when a government fails to do its job, all of that goes. Now you're left to dole which you haven't been able to dole before. So if you're only 39 to 40%, I think it's around 39% of the folks who live there own their own houses, that was 60% of the population didn't own their houses, didn't get the insurance money, didn't get anything but maybe relocation money that might have sent them to Utah, of all places. So, you know, where I appreciate and love the way that town, that city, was able to rebuild itself. And I remember going through it and seeing all of the American flags on the trees and mm-hmm. all. And I remember, I have pictures of it up and down. I remember it greatly. And I said, wow, what great circumstances. And obviously not knowing the other circumstances. But there is two parts. And one is the fact that in New Orleans, it was, and not only New Orleans, but Slidell and Baton Rouge and a couple of more of the parishes that black folk lived or that black folk couldn't even go into to even save themselves, that there is two stories, or as Spike Lee has said, and it's saying there are actually three stories of the Katrina story, and that's New Orleans, that's in the Mississippi-Texas coast, and then the other story.
So what do you both think about the differences in these stories? When you look at your story, Kathleen Koch, mm-hmm. and I do want to read your book and may have you back just to talk about the book. My producers found you this morning, and now we know
that's all right. I won't hold it against you that you didn't read it in 7 or 8 hours. It's okay.
If I had it, I would have tried. But what both of you think about why there is such a difference in these American stories? Why there's such a wide difference? Is it class? Is it community? Is it race? Is it dislocation, the dispossessed and those who have possessions, and how people respond to these things? I'm curious what you think is different about these two stories.
Well, let me share one thing. I think that because, you know, if anyone has been watching the wonderful HBO series Tremé, you heard part of it from John Goodman in his rant on the banks of the Mississippi River right at the start of the series. He said what happened on the Mississippi Gulf Coast was a natural disaster, hurricane pure and simple. But what happened in New Orleans, you know, was a man-made disaster, decades in the making, because the levees were never properly designed, properly constructed, properly maintained. So
well,
I think
this
right
Tremé
off
the rant that was at the
right,
beginning
exactly,
of the documentary.
Wonderful rant. But I think that also right off the bat explains to you there's a difference in the philosophy in the take on what happened. What happened in New Orleans was preventable. It was done to them. I think, and correct me, you know, Michael, if I'm wrong, but that increases the sense of victimhood. I mean, this should not have happened. This could have been stopped. In Mississippi, it was just Mother Nature. And so there was less to rail against. There was less fury and anger seething inside. Not that people didn't suffer, but, so you came at it right off the bat from very different perspectives. What do you think, Michael?
I think Katrina exposed the impoverishment, of human security in an important but vulnerable, region. It showed you how the impoverishment, the racism, the poor folk were not prepared. The government was not prepared to handle them. And I agree with you when you say that the Mississippi-Texas region was a storm. And folk stepped up and did what you're supposed to do after a storm hit, where everybody else was, it's like a house of cards. You know, when you put another card on, it start wobbling. And you say to yourself, well, I better put another card on. Well, the levees was just a stack of cards. And when it happened, everyone was befuddled. Nah, I was stunned by so much down there when I was down there that it just took me away from more of community activism to human rights activism. But no, I agree with you. It's I guess I said before, it's two to three different stories, and 5 years later, it hasn't gotten back too much better.
Mm-hmm. Your town is very different.
Well, we still have vast areas that haven't recovered, very much like in New Orleans. The areas that haven't come back for us are the areas along the water. It's just a home here, a home there. A lot of those structures just probably will never be rebuilt because of the cost of insurance. If you can scrape together the money to rebuild your home on or near the water, your insurance payments will be higher than your mortgage. And just the economy is struggling there so much now. I think a lot of people just don't see a way to make a life there anymore, particularly after the oil spill. Our town was right back on track to start to hit pre-Katrina levels with tax income from sales taxes, property taxes, casino taxes. And then the oil spill occurred in April, and May tax receipts just plummeted. I was in Waveland a couple weeks ago at a restaurant that I write about at the end of the book, the West End, and they're sitting there, terrific restaurant, great food, right next to a shopping center that still sits there, empty. Not a single business reopened. The ceilings collapsed in, weeds growing up out of the parking lot, just a wasteland. And so she's trying to make a go of her business and had been doing really well, but again, the oil spill. She said, last May, at the height of the recession, I made $10,000 more than this May. And am I going to get that money back from BP? No. And I just think a lot of it's not going to come back until, the economy, the people won't come back, the homes won't come back until the economy gets back on its feet. And I don't know when that's going to be now.
It's a double dose down there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty tough. It's a crisis of public policy. It was a crisis of public policy. I mean, let's be clear that the Bush administration cut half the budgets for the levees in the New Orleans area back in 2001 for funds requested by the Corps of Engineers. And it was just, wide open to happen. But as we digress, and then, of course, when you come to the oil, we were lucky that it wasn't, it was horrible, 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 but we're lucky it wasn't worse. It was a storm away from being worse.
But you still wonder, Michael, and that's what I hear from my friends down there on the Gulf Coast. They just don't know. Is it gone? What happened to those millions of gallons of oil that poured into the Gulf? And so is anyone going to do longitudinal studies on the people in Louisiana and Mississippi who make their lives off the water, whether they're shrimpers, whether they're oil workers going out to the rigs every couple weeks, people living on the water, eating the seafood every day, going out there in the water with their kids, fishing, shrimping, floundering, will there be cancer clusters that occur? People are terrified, and they think, BP is going to pay off and then go on and say, okay, we're done. And well, then 10, 15 years later, we'll have these clusters in.
Part of the problem with the way they're managing the suit with BP, the payments from BP is that they're not talking about what may happen years out. They're only
right.
talking about immediate things that are happening as of the spill.
And it's the same philosophy like with the insurance companies after Katrina. People who have nothing will take anything. So they're offering them something and then saying, and you'll never be able to sue. Sign on the dotted line. Take the money.
And then you also we are more and more information is coming out about the amount of oil that was not recaptured, that it may have dissipated on the surface, but if it's beneath,
it's still there.
What's happening to the shrimp beds? What's happening to the oysters? What's happening to the fish that are spawning in the Gulf?
Entire ecosystem.
This is why I think that it's important and. For us in our industry, my industry, also your industry, Kathleen, to stay on top of these stories and to keep these conversations alive, because people really do have to know what is going on, and it gets away from the public eye. And then part of our job in the media is to keep Power's feet to the fire and keep people informed, so people don't get away with murder, not literal murder, but the murder of not paying attention to what has to be paid attention to.
And I don't think murder is not a bad word.
Michael Johnson, see you when you come through back to Baltimore.
Yeah, tomorrow.
Thank you. Glad you for joining us today.
Sure.
Who is founder and executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute. Kathleen Koch, former CNN correspondent, reported live from the Gulf during the Hurricane Katrina about her hometown, Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. Her book is Rising from Katrina, My Mississippi Hometown, Lost It All and Found What Mattered. And again, this Thursday, August 26th at 7 p.m., you can meet Kathleen Koch at the Barnes & Noble at 4300 Montgomery Road in Ellicott City to sign copies of her book and hear her talk about her book. And folks, thank you all for being with us today. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Stephanie Mavronis, Daniel Gillespie, Richard Good, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out more about the shows you do hear on this program, you can visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.